Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Reel 18. Now, what happened when you got to Abu Swer? That's where you dropped the Oxford off, wasn't it?
Yeah, we delivered the Oxford to Abu Swer, and then I think we were billeted at Ismailia, which is about 10 miles down the road. And whilst we were there in transit, we were obviously going to carry on with our flying training, and the aim of the exercise, I suppose, was to move us down to one of the other flying training schools. So whilst we were at Abu Swer, or billeted in Ismailia, they put us to carry on flying at the local OTU, Operational Training Unit, number 71. So we flew for 13 or 14 days. When I say we flew, that was myself and the other students. We were doing circus and bumps just to keep our hand in.
And what aircraft?
A Harvard.
And what was a Harvard like?
Now, I did it. The first trip I went there, I was initiated into Blenheim. And I did 50 minutes in this Blenheim. Seconds and landings, and I just could not cope with it, quite frankly. I suppose it was psychological. B, the smell of the aircraft, and
what do you mean psychological? Just
well, it was a Blenheim I'd been flying when this guy got shot, and that was the last time I'd flown in a Blenheim virtually. And I suppose even with the intervening period of time, the aircraft have got their own peculiar smells, you know, and things like that, and I wasn't very happy about this. So I said to the guy, don't like this, do you think I could have something else? So they put me on to the Harvard. Now, the Harvard was an intermediate trainer, very powerful aircraft, low-wing monoplane, tractable undercarriage. All the students, all the fighter pilots, inverted commas, students, were trained to fly Harvards. Well, I hadn't flown a single engine aircraft since the Tagamoth days, way back. So it was quite a new experience. So I did about 6 hours.
Now, these were from Abu Swer? Or you were staying at Ismailia?
No, Ismailia, actually, physically.
There was an airfield at Ismailia as well.
Oh, yeah, there's a big airfield. It's international.
And which operational training unit was it?
71 OTU.
But you were just attached to it. You weren't part of it.
No, we were just attached. We're still in transit to carry on. I suppose they were trying to make up their mind what they wanted to do with us. So I did 6 hours on a Harvard there, I believe. Anyway. So, to cut a long story short, the next move...
Nothing else happened there, then?
No, not really. Not really, no. We're just trying to keep our hand in, so to speak, for 13 days whilst we waited on passages down to 23 SFTS. That's where the 23 came from. 23 SFTS.
Now, S stands for...
Service Flying Training School, as opposed to intermediate or elementary. Now, the SFTS was at Heaney in Bulawayo, outside...
How do you spell Heaney?
H-E-A-N-Y. Heaney. Big camp. Very, very big camp. Near Bulawayo. But
That's South Africa, is it?
Sorry? It was South Africa. Southern Rhodesia. I don't know what they call it now. Yeah, Harare they call it now, don't they, I think? Yeah. Yeah. But
How did you get down there?
I was just going to say, we got down there by devious means, to wit... Oh, yes, we flew by flying boat from Cairo, again, up the Nile. But this time we landed in the Vaal Dam in South Africa, outside Johannesburg. I don't think there's no flying boats there anymore, anyway. And then we trained from there up to southern Rhodesia, Bulawayo. It was quite a long trip. I don't quite know how long it was, actually.
And what happened next? What was your reception like when you got there?
Oh, when we got to got to Johannesburg, the people fell over backwards to look after us. It was back into civilization. We were the first sort of Air Force types they'd ever seen, and lots of welfare, lots of outings, lots of people coming to see us. Lots of girls falling over backwards to see us. Some nice girls too, very sophisticated. But anyway, that was very brief, and we pressed on up then to Nairobi. And
you mean Bulawayo?
Beg your pardon, Bulawayo. Yes. So we got back. Multi-engine people, Asagesa, who were flying Oxford, went to Heaney, but the other pilots on the course who were flying single-engine aircraft were dispersed around southern Rhodesia to the Harvard training schools. There was quite a number of them. There was more Harvard training schools around there. Don't ask me to remind me of, but there was quite a few. But Heaney was 15 miles, I remember, from Bulawayo, along a track, very vivid. The road, inverted commas, was just two tarmac strips, 18 inches wide, the width of a vehicle. That was the road. There's only one way. If you had to pass somebody, you had to move off the strip.
Now, what was the base like, the station?
It was a very big station. Oh, an extremely large station, very well set out. It was just starting up, I think, at that time, 1941. We were billeted on the station, of course, and we had a number of South African Air Force students as well, who were obviously resident. I can't remember who the CO was, but it was a wooden type structure, I seem to remember. Very vast camp. But it was consigned to training twin engine pilots. We had a bit of a hiccup because on the reinforcement side was one of the ships which was bringing out the ground staff was torpedoed and sank, and they lost either the fitters or the riggers or a lot of the technical tradesmen we wanted, so we were short on certain. I think it was nearly all riggers we lost, so that curtailed our flying. But when we got this FTS, this FTS was the second phase, i.e., we had completed the intermediate. Now we were going on to what they termed the advanced, and this is learning to use the aeroplane. For which it was designed. In this case, we were learning to use it as a bomber. We were learning cross-country navigation, night flying.
And which aircraft?
Oxford, still Oxford. Still Oxford. That blind flying, night flying, low-level bombing, finding... finding wind speed and direction for the purposes of bombing. That was usually done with a student flying it and a student doing the wind speed, and then we'd swap over in the air and carry on, just to spread out the time. The trips only lasted about 40 minutes, but we were packed in. We'd do two or three a day in some instances. We even did some photography, oblique photography, which was another part of the system. Also, I noticed we did blind flying approach procedure. That was using the ground controllers directing the pilots, assuming the weather was bad, but directing the pilots to come in and touch down in the so-called nil visibility situation. But we did it time and time about. Mostly we were flying with another student. I see the guy I was flying with was the name of Hilton. One of the cross-country navigation exercises which we had graduated to, I seem to remember, it was a night cross-country. I mentioned it early on about navigation. We were doing this cross-country right out into the Bundu, as the phrase is. The nights in Rhodesia were very black. That was a thing that impressed me, that they were extremely dark. But you had stars, but they were still dark. And I remember doing this cross-country exercise with a staff pilot and my navigator. You're taught to complete your navigation log in a certain fashion. You write down the various entries. The argument being that if you make a mistake and you refer back, you can see your errors. Well, I was writing my entries down and I had given the guy a course correction. And when I looked at my previous entries, I had noticed that I was, as we said, I put red on black. I had put 180 degrees error, so I was not despondent in any shape or form. The drill was quite simple. All you did was you projected your existing flight 5 minutes forward, and then you gave him a course correction. I don't know what the guy said, actually, but I gave him a course correction, which, of course, was 180 degrees difference to the previous one. So obviously, he must have realized that what had happened. But there wasn't any comment. We got back to base. But I often thought that if it continued on that close, we would have been missing forever because we'd be finished up in the middle of Africa somewhere in the jungle. But that passed all right. Pilot now test, I see we had there in Oxford, and did that as well. Yeah, photographic work, and the importance
seemed
to
concern. Do you know much about photographic work? What was there to do with what were you learning about photographic work?
Photographic work, well, first of all, you had to navigate to the point you want to take your pictures, and then you have to assess your line overlap. That's the film over the two pictures overlap by 60%, so you have to calculate the amount of exposures you want to make over the distance. And the most important thing is you've got to eliminate the drift. So you have to check on the drift to make sure you've eliminated the drift by offsetting the camera so that you get all the photographs in a straight line. Yeah, it was quite interesting. I'd done a lot of that in the desert. So it didn't come in as anything. But I noticed there's a lot of blind approach systems working here, which is important, actually. Would have been important later on in years, I guess.
What was it? What was it like on blind approach? This is with.
Well, you just listen. The modern day is. you'll hear the controller say, "I've got your, whatever your number is, a call sign is. I will give you instructions. Do not acknowledge and carry on and do as instructed. And you turn left, turn right, look down at a rate of descent. And the idea that you've got two markers on the ground which you don't see, radio markers, and he's looking at a plan, but this was the early stages when it was nearly all visual. They had to plot you down a glide slope, so it seemed to be all right. Bombing seemed to be not too bad, which we did, and then subsequently that took me from all the way through from...
So you got there in, what, July?
Yeah, I went to September. That's when we got them, yeah.
Anything else about your train? It sounds quite busy.
Oxford. Yeah, we arrived on the 31st June. June we arrived in... No, I'll tell a lie, it wasn't June. It was August we arrived at Heaney, Bulawayo. That was the first trip. We still did a bit of ground instruction, but mainly flying. And we flew right through until the last trip was September. Oh, 16th. That was only 6 weeks, wasn't it? 6 weeks. Mind you, the weather was good. We clocked up a few hours and 19 19 hours and some night flying.
Did you have any particular problems with your flying? I mean, some pilots have problems with this or that.
Yeah, we had one guy on the course when we first got to 4FTS. He was a brilliant flyer. The trouble was he couldn't judge over the desert. He couldn't judge the height of the landing, and he was washed out. Helberg was his name. It was a Swede, a Norwegian, I think. Nice guy. But no, I didn't. I just managed to.
How were you assessed at the end of the course?
I'm just looking to see. It says average.
How did they average. Do that? Was it, is that just their opinion, or was it marked?
No, that's the assessment. Has shown aptitude as a pilot navigator. That was a line shoot. And it's just assessment average. It tells you the total flying, sums it up. Yeah, got a rubber stamp here. And qualified. Well, that was the second. Yeah, that's the second endorsement, qualifying water flying badge, which we actually physically got it there. We felt at the time when we were all paraded and we had earned it.
Now, what about life, you know, on the ground there? I mean, was it comfortable? Was it a comfortable base?
It was a permanent pre-war. It was fine. I mean, it had a good facilities, but we didn't seem to have much time to go out, as far as I remember. Went into Bulawayo once or twice, local hotels and things. They had a swimming pool in Bulawayo. I remember we went to the swimming pool in Bulawayo. That was quite nice. Got some pictures of that. But nothing else. I think, I don't think there's any.
So in September, what was the next stage?
So the next, having said that, the postings came through, and I was posted along with others back to the Middle East. I remember this. I've not got any record over here. But I applied to the flight commander, and I said, look, I've been out in the Middle East since 1938-ish. I said, you know, is there any possibility of getting my posting changed to home posting? So he said, well, I don't know, but yeah, I'll see what I can do. So the next thing is the CO sent for me, and he said, yeah, certainly, he said, we'll post you to UK. You've got about 15 minutes to get down that 15 miles to the railway station. So I have an old pack, kit was packed for me. But so I was posted to UK, number 3 Personnel Reception Centre. And we embarked from Cape Town. So we had to get from Bulawayo to Cape Town by train. So we embarked on the 4th of October from Cape Town. That was quite a nice trip down by train, night leisurely. Good reception at Cape Town, again, with the very people. We managed to see a few of the sights, not much. And then we embarked on this ship called the Christian Huggins. We called it the Hungry Christian. It was a Far Eastern cruise liner of 15,000 tons, and it had never seen the light of day in the UK waters, so it steamed into Cape Town from the Far East, and it was carrying a lot of the wounded survivors from the HMS Repulse and Renown. There were, I think there was about 10 RAF sergeants and a couple of officers from our course on it.
And this is what, November?
This is October 41.
October, sorry.
There was a few, there was one or two Air Force guys. But there was, and all these walking wounded, nearly all Navy. So it wasn't a lot of population on board, but for a big ship, 15,000 tons, but the accommodation was mediocre. What wasn't right was the food. It was diabolical on this ship, really was. That's why it got the nickname Hungry Christian. But I've been a write-up on that as well. But we left Cape Town on the 4th of October, and we steamed across the South Atlantic due west, and then we hit the South Atlantic, hit the south coast of America, and we turned north, and we steamed due north. And so we finished up in Halifax, Nova Scotia. 3 weeks, we're out of sight of land for 3 weeks. I remember that loud and clear. And all the only duties we had were, when the siren went, the RAF sergeants had to man the small arms machine guns, which was quite was all right. I remember there were Hotchkiss. They were French, but they had a slide. The ammunition was on a slide. But so when the balloon actually went, if there was any action, we had immediately relinquished the guns and hand them over to the merchant navy guys, which we didn't please us very much, because we had fired them. They used to put up smoke things and we used to fire at them, so we were quite good at it. But then when the balloon were real for real, we handed over to these. Anyway, that wasn't very popular. When I arrived at, we arrived in UK on the 24th of November. That was 20 days, that was. Gosh, truth. I thought it was longer than that.
No, that's longer than that.
20 days.
You left in October.
You left in October.
And you got back halfway through
November. Exactly, right. 20 days at sea. 20 days at sea. That doesn't disembark. Must be right. But I know when we went to Halifax, we went to Brunswick first. Brunswick. Oh, couldn't have been. Must have been longer than that. I wouldn't like to say that date's correct. But we went to into Brunswick, and the ship went into dry dock there, and we were in dry dock for about 10 days. And I know it was over the Halloween period.
It started in October, you got there in November. That's nearly 6 weeks.
Oh, yeah, 6, that's right. So I was thinking it was a month, it's more than that.
Yeah,
that would be right then, that would be right. Well, we went into dry dock in New Brunswick because this ship, having come across from the Far East, they had to weld up all the portholes close to the waterline, and that was a standard drill for North Atlantic passage of ships. Weld them on the outside plate, steel plates. Anyway, that took 10 days. In the meantime, we were allowed to go ashore into Brunswick, I suppose, yeah, into the town. Had a nice time there. Looked after us quite well, met a few people. The funny things that happened was that, A, it was strange. I remember it was new. It was Halloween, and this trick and treat business that they have, which is a modern way, and we couldn't grasp that at the time because it was all strange to us. This trick or treat, we went to these local dances. The girls looked after us very well, actually, but it was a bit. And then suddenly the ship went to sea. You know, we were made all our arrangements to meet the following day, only to find that drop anchor and off, literally. So we never did say our farewells properly. But then we joined a convoy, and quite a big convoy across the North Atlantic. And our escort, I remember, this was before the Americans came into the war, actually. I remember this escort of American Navy vessels. God, there was more Navy vessels than that. And they steamed either side of us and the convoy and shepherded us out into the mid-Atlantic. All the time, these American vessels were flying off a Kingfisher. It was a single-engine float plane, monoplane, which we were quite interested in because they used to do a recce and come back. And in order to land on the water, they used to put the helm hard over and smooth the water out, and it would come in and land in, and it'd be yanked up with a crane. It was quite interesting for a few days. kept us occupied. I didn't have things to do, actually. I was going to play cards or housey, that type of thing. You had your cabin inspections every morning anyway. But I think, if I remember right, it was four of us a cabin, something like that. But being NCOs, we really didn't do any chores. We were sort of excused, not like the first time. But that was quite interesting. When we got halfway across the Atlantic, when we woke up the following morning, it wasn't a ship to be seen. The American escort had gone halfway and left us, and there we were steaming along merrily in this sort of convoy. Mind you, the convoy must have been doing about 50 knots. It was, and away on the horizon, I remember seeing on both sides a ship, and this turned out to be the British escort. Two ships. One as far, well, they must have been about 17 miles away each side. But anyway, that prevailed all the way through, right up. And we got into home waters, and I remember the convoy steaming up the Clyde. This was really quite emotional for me. Coming home after being away from 1938 to 1941, I was in this ship, and I was steaming up the Clyde in this big 15,000-ton vessel, and I could see my home. I could see where I lived from the deck of the ship. And I thought, oh, great, we'll get a pass tonight. We'll be home tonight, see my mum. Yeah, and the next thing is the ship about turns and sails down to Liverpool. So I didn't get home, much to my disgust. We got to Liverpool, and we had a big reception committee there. The mayor turned out and all the people. And we had been briefed, of course. Well, we were alleged to have been briefed that we were starving back in UK. When we came from Cape Town, we loaded up with sugar and jam and cigarettes and stuff like that. So my kit bag was full of, inverted commas, contraband, so to speak, cigarettes particularly. Anyway, when we got ashore, there was this incredible spread laid on by the local mayor in the town church hall or somewhere. I've never seen so much food, sugar and jam and cream and all. That was a waste of my time. My mother said exactly the same thing. Oh, she shouldn't have bothered. She said, we've got plenty of that. But that was my reaction on the ship. But I was given some disembarkation leave, as we got in these days, and I was posted to, on January the 18th, to 5302U,